Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, July 23rd, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today we're talking about the Jeffrey Epstein files. Fallout over the lack of transparency and the Jeffrey Epstein case has dominated headlines for weeks, and the pressure is only growing. Attorney General Pam Bondi initially promised to release all the Epstein files, including the so-called client list. Then she backed out. Now even some of Trump's most loyal supporters are demanding answers. The MAGA base appears rattled, and the president is scrambling to control the narrative, but it's not working. And so today on the show, we're going to look at what's conspiracy, what's fact, and we're going to talk about what's still secret and why so many Americans on both sides of the aisle think that there is a cover-up. We'll also talk about the current politics surrounding it all, and we have a great panel. We have investigative journalist Julie Brown, who's reporting for the Miami Herald, exposed Epstein's crimes. We also have Will Sommer from The Bulwark, who's been covering far-right politics for years, and we want you to weigh in on this. This is really, I think, a show that we would love to hear from our audience, and our questions of the day are this. Do you think all of the Epstein files should be released, and how do you think the decision will impact Trump's relationship with his MAGA base? The number is 888-477-9499 for you to call. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello. Put those comments in the live chat.
And if you don't know, Julie K. Brown from Philly.
Yes. Always a Philadelphia connection.
Yeah. And such a pivotal figure in all of this. Her reporting really reopened this case.
Yeah.
And so really excited to have her and Will on the program today. Again, that number is 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And Sherry said she wants to hear from you.
Yes.
So you better call. Three local stories. Let's start with the first one. There's a big fight right now over who should be the top federal prosecutor in the state of New Jersey. Alina Haba is a Widener-educated South Jersey lawyer who rose very quickly to become one of President Trump's personal defense attorneys. Trump appointed Haba to be New Jersey's U.S. attorney on a temporary basis earlier this year. But her temporary term expires after 120 days. She has not been confirmed by the U.S. Senate. So into the fray stepped a panel of federal judges, and in a pretty rare move, they not only declined to extend Haba's appointment, they instead elevated her second in command to the top prosecutor position. Now, if you're still with me, if you're still following, here comes the DOJ and Pam Bondi. She'll reappear later in this show. Bondi almost immediately responded to the firing of Haba by firing the person that the judges had selected to replace Haba. And so all in all, it's very confusing as to A, who's running this prosecutorial office, and B, what exactly is going to happen moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the panel of judges, it is rare, but it's not unprecedented for judges to do that. They've done it in other cases, according to reporting in The Hill. But what was interesting to me is that, you know, there's a lot of questions over whether the attorney general can actually fire someone in this position, because under the U.S. Constitution, only the president has the power to appoint U.S. attorneys, which must be confirmed by the Senate. And only the president has the power to fire them. Right. And so, you know, Attorney General Pam Bondi has sort of spoken up here, said she's going to fire someone. There's some questions about whether or not she could do that. You know, the president could always just step in and appoint someone else and allow the Senate to do their confirmation hearing. So this is like the battle of the wills, it seems, between judges and Attorney General Pam Bondi here.
And it's notable that the Senate has not taken up her confirmation, given that they've moved many confirmations through the process already. Also to be noted, Haba had no experience as a prosecutor or in criminal law prior to getting this appointment in New Jersey. So that perhaps explains why the Senate doesn't seem thrilled about the possibility of installing her on a more permanent basis.
Yes, moving on to our second story. We're sticking with politics a little bit here. Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman made headlines over a bill he introduced that would keep businesses from going cashless. It's called the Payment Choice Act. It will require any business with a physical location to be prepared to take cash payments up to $500. And shops would also be barred from charging people paying cash a higher price.
Does that happen? I've literally never seen that.
I've never seen that either.
I've seen the opposite. You pay more
for having a credit card. Yeah. Exactly. But that's in the bill. And in a press release, Fetterman goes to bat for the bankless, you know, people without bank accounts. He says, quote, "There are millions of people in this country who don't have bank accounts and they must be able to go shopping with their hard-earned dollars." And all of this sort of came to a head, you remember, Avi, during the pandemic.
Sure.
When, you know, a lot of businesses sort of went cashless because you didn't know how COVID was spread and money is pretty dirty, right? And so people they wanted to have touchless, you know, purchases where you didn't have to touch money or anything. You could just pay by tapping, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so that has sort of been the shift. Now many stadiums, there's a lot of places that do not take cash, a lot of parking garages, parking lots. And in fact, Philadelphia became one of the first municipalities to go cashless.
We love being first in Philly.
Yeah, to one of the first places to actually ban, you know, this cashless trend back in 2019. And there are some exceptions like parking garages and parking lots. But, you know, Philadelphia said, look, you got to be able to accept cash. And we were one of the first municipalities to go in that direction.
So the question could be framed one way, and I think most people will frame it this way, which is it good, ethical for a business to not accept cash?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's less the question than should the government mandate it, right? Because that shifts the window a little bit. Is this the government's role to step in and tell a business you have to accept cash? That's what Fetterman is proposing.
Yes.
And so to me, that's a slightly different debate. And we'll see how it all shakes out. You know,
we'll see if he gets, you know, the type of support to get this type of bill over the line and what the House will do. But it is interesting, this whole shift that, you know, cash is slowly becoming no longer king in the sense.
Yeah.
And that most people, I know I rarely carry cash these days. I got cash, you know, for a concert that I was going to, and the place did not accept cash. I had to use my card.
So I've now, so often had the other experience where you've got the card. You're like, oh, shoot, I forgot to get cash. And then they're like, no, we're not taking cards here.
Yeah.
I've had that experience many times. They have to go to the ATM and they charge like $250. That's aggravating.
Yeah, it's expensive to
should
get
they have
your
a bill
own money.
About that?
They shouldn't charge you to get access to your own money. I would support that.
Oh, no, a new bill.
Uh-huh.
The Cherry Gregg ATM Suck Act.
I know, that's right.
Okay, story number three. There is a bat flip in a South Jersey Little League game that has led to a star player being suspended and an emergency lawsuit. Cherry, this story from NJ.com is absolutely wild. It revolves around a 12-year-old player named Marco who plays for Haddonfield Little League. He hit a home run recently. Good job, Marco.
Go ahead, Marco.
And he flipped his bat in celebration. We have the video up if you're watching on YouTube right now. Wait for it. He hits the home run and he flips the bat in the air in celebration. All right. Nothing wrong with that, you would think.
Mm-hmm.
According to Marco's dad, Little League International said flipping the bat was a safety issue and that he violated their ban on horseplay. So they suspended him.
Wow.
They suspended Marco for the next game. And this game is in the state championship round as Haddonfield tries to make it to the Little League World Series, the big Little League World Series in Williamsport. So now Team Marco has filed an emergency temporary restraining order to get him reinstated for the big state championship game tomorrow. Oh, my gosh. The bat flip heard around the world in South Jersey.
Wow. And this you know, stuck out to me because the dad, Marco's dad, said that bat flipping had been promoted by Little League International. It's on their social media, websites, game broadcasts, and his son sort of watched that. But then it also raised a lot of questions to me about, you know, celebration, because you've seen a lot of young athletes get stripped of titles, you know, get disqualified for celebrating. Most recently, a California sprinter was stripped of her state title because her dad gave her a fire extinguisher after the race and she sprayed her cleats, right?
That's awesome.
That was awesome after she won her 400-meter
game. Not awesome that she got in trouble. Oh, that's an awesome celebration.
It's an awesome celebration, but this has happened every year or two.
Yeah.
There's a big celebration of an athlete who's won, and then...
I would say I would tend toward let them play, let them celebrate, unless you're really hurting someone's feelings. By the way, I did look this up. Mm-hmm. The Little League safety code says, quote, at no time should horseplay be permitted on the playing field. And I have to say, if I was a 12-year-old today, I would not interpret that. I'm sure he didn't know the rules.
As a bat, yeah.
As a ban on bat flipping. That's not, like, maybe 30, 40 years ago, people would have thought of bat flipping as horseplay because it was less common. But these days in baseball,
it's on the, yeah,
flipping
it's
a bat in celebration is much more, like, common and sanctioned. So, to me, that makes it doubly unfair.
Yeah. Poor Marco. All right, we're going to be talking about the Epstein files on the other side of this. Do you think all the Epstein files should be released? How do you think it'll impact the decision with Trump's supporters? That on the other side of the break. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news. It can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Jeffrey Epstein was a serial sexual predator who, reporting indicates, abused hundreds of young women and girls over multiple decades. And I'm going to lead with that because it does seem to have been lost in the frenzied political discussion of Epstein's prosecution and death.
But the politics of the Epstein scandal are real. So much so that House Speaker Mike Johnson just sent Congress home rather than hold votes related to the Epstein case. Why has this case animated conspiracy theorists like few others? And does it pose a unique political challenge for Donald Trump, who has survived countless scandals before?
We will attempt to answer those questions this hour with the help of Julie K. Brown, investigative journalist for the Miami Herald, who helped expose Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. She's the author of Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story. Julie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
Let me also welcome Will Sommer, senior writer for The Bulwark. Will, great to have you as well on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, we invite you to participate in the conversation. Our questions are this. Do you think all of the Epstein files should be released? And how do you think the decision will impact President Trump's relationship with his supporters? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the live chat.
Julie, I wanted to start with you. When you began your reporting into this case, give us a synopsis of what had happened up to that point. So almost like that first phase before your reporting led to kind of where we are now. So give us that synopsis, that lead up until like the mid-2010s.
Well, Jeffrey Epstein was investigated by the town of Palm Beach Police Department in around 2005. And they discovered at least a half a dozen underage girls had been molested by him. However, Epstein, once he knew he was under investigation, hired some very high-powered attorneys and was able to persuade, or they were able to persuade, the Palm Beach state attorney to sort of give him a slap on the wrist plea deal. The police detective who was investigating it took the case over his head then to the FBI and to the Department of Justice in out of Palm Beach, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of Florida, telling them, look, you've got to take this case, you've got to look at it because there's more to it, and the state attorney is going to just give him a slap on the wrist. They interviewed more women, came forward by this time, and they started once again working with Epstein's attorneys. Somehow, there was pressure put upon the Justice Department by his attorneys. They were able to, again, get him some kind of a real lenient plea deal that was kind of done under the cover of secrecy. And he essentially, went and had a very cushy lenient jail term, and no one really understood the depth of his crimes until much later. And then by the time it was realized that he had gotten this sweetheart deal. He had already been released from prison, served his 18 months, and returned, quite frankly, we know now, returned to abusing young girls and women after his release from jail. The media covered it extensively once they found out what the deal was, and there was some coverage of it, but in my mind, I felt like there was still a lot that we didn't know. And I decided at the time in 2016 when I took it up that that it was time to take a maybe a fresh look at it because there were still too many questions in my mind about how he was able to get away with abusing so many underage girls, return to his jet setting life essentially. How does that happen?
Yeah. And Julie, I want you to continue because your reporting sort of exposed the extent of his crimes and also some of his connections that were able to keep much of this undercover. Can you talk about your reporting a little bit, what you found, and then sort of the reaction that landed Jeffrey Epstein behind bars?
Well, there was one thing missing from all the coverage that had been done in that case. An important piece of it, I think, was the fact that the victims weren't given a voice. They were underage at the time, so they were minors. We didn't really know who they were because their names were secret for obvious reasons. And I felt that that was a big piece that was missing, that the victims had never spoken about this. So one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing, quite frankly, was trying to find them and get them to trust me enough to talk to me. And I think that that was one of the key differences in my coverage. The other thing that I did that no other reporter had done before is I actually got the lead detective and the chief of police in Palm Beach to talk to me about how the pressure that they confronted with trying to bring Epstein to justice. I mean, the police faced a lot of I mean, Epstein hired private detectives to even follow the police. And follow the lead detective and follow the victims and follow their families. These kinds of details were things that hadn't been reported or had been had limited reporting. And I think that pressure really opened people's eyes to the fact that there were probably some very powerful people behind Epstein who was allowing him to conduct himself in this way.
I want to read back something you wrote when you were reporting out this story in the mid to late 2010s. You wrote, "It would be easy to dismiss the Epstein case as another example of how there are two systems of justice in America, one for the rich and one for the poor. But a thorough analysis of the case tells a far more troubling story. To what extent do you believe that more troubling story has actually been told or revealed to this point? Do we have a good grasp of what that more troubling story is, or do you feel like there are still major holes in that second story?"
It's still being covered up. I mean, there is so much that is being covered up. I mean, it's not just one piece that's missing. It's a lot of things that are missing. The victims, after Epstein's death, there was a victims compensation fund, for example, that was set up. And supposedly, some 200 women were able to collect settlements from that. So that's at least 200 victims there. I don't believe that any of them had been interviewed by the Justice Department. That's number one. Number two, we know that Epstein made a lot of financial transactions in the actually within days of my story running in 2018. He was wiring money all over the place. And I've always questioned why the feds didn't follow the money, for example, and see how did he get his money for the for anyway? I mean, that's never been fully explored to my knowledge. So that's just two pieces right there that I don't think the Department of Justice has ever really had the courage or the wherewithal to investigate. And third piece, by the way, is the potential that Epstein what had some kind of intelligence behind him, that he was doing some work either for foreign countries or perhaps for our own government intelligence work. Those are questions that have been asked, and I don't have the confidence that the DOJ has ever really explored those angles
So I
to
think
his
the big
performance.
question that I have at this point is, has that investigation into his financial transactions, how he built his wealth, which is deeply mysterious, what you said about whether they sort of followed the money. The question that I have is, have they looked into that and simply not revealed their findings, or have they not looked into it at all? Because those are two different versions potentially of a cover-up. Do you have a sense of which one is the more likely one?
I have a sense, but just dealing as a journalist with facts, I would have to say I really don't know for sure. But I do think that when they arrested Epstein, they focused their attention on trying to convict Epstein with minimal, investigations. They were trying to get at the victims to testify, for example. And then when he died, they did the same thing with Maxwell. I noticed that there were key people I knew had information about Epstein's and Maxwell's sex trafficking organization that weren't interviewed. So I suspect that they narrowed their lane as far as what they wanted to accomplish and really didn't go beyond that. That's what
Is
I
that
suspect.
unusual, though? I guess I have to, because I do know prosecutors can really focus in on just getting a conviction. It looks good for the resume. A lot of these people are very ambitious. Is it unusual to sort of take the narrow path just to get a conviction, even if you don't get the full conspiracy? Or do you think what happened here is more of the unusual variety, where they were super narrow in their focus in a way that sort of defies precedent and explanation?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that in a yes or no way. This is what I do know. It still would be very hard to get a conviction based on events that happened 20 years ago. The trial for Ghislaine Maxwell, which I attended every day, it was very difficult for the victims. Their statements and their testimony wasn't always consistent with what they told authorities, years earlier. And that's common. That is a common thing, especially with trauma victims and sexual assault su survivors. But it was very painful and it was a very difficult conviction to get. But here's what I think that they should do. I think that they can get something just based on perhaps money laundering. They can get some of these men, or just to look at the money and try to figure out, there can't, not all of these transfers could be legal. I mean, my feeling is they're suspect. And I do think that if they want a different way and they, the proverbial follow the money way, they may be able to get more answers than the way they were looking at this case in the past, which was depending on victims who had been through so much already, and that their recollections might not lead to a conviction. Not to mention that the statute of limitations, this is also a problem.
Yeah, we're getting quite a few comments from our listeners. And our question of the day is this: do you think all of the Epstein files should be released? How do you think the decision will impact President Trump's relationship with his supporters? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the chat. I'm going to read a couple of our comments and then bring in a caller. We have Bill who says, anyone who thinks the Epstein files will be released without heavy redactions when the current party in power is in them probably also believes that The Late Show with Stephen Colbert was terminated due to purely financial reasons. That's Bill's thoughts. We have Rob on YouTube who says, I believe that Trump isn't just on the list, that he is a co-conspirator. There are too many connections between these men to believe otherwise. I want to bring in Anita from Conshohocken, who's been on the line. Anita, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is, even if he is implemented in all of this,
The he is Trump,
he'll
Anita.
find
Are
a
you talking
way.
about Trump?
Yes.
Okay.
Who else? And do you think he would offer Maxwell some kind of a deal in order not to implicate him? And as far as his supporters go, How can they be so blind?
Yeah.
I mean, if any one of us were to do half the things that he has done, we'd be behind bars.
Yeah. That's Anita That is Anita from Conshohocken, giving her comments to our question of the day. And so I want to bring you into the conversation, Will, and I wanted you to sort of pick up where Julie left off in her reporting. And so to bring us into the world of right-wing politics and where this sort of the Jeffrey Epstein case sort of became a focal point, can you bring us in and tell us what about this case sort of hooked many people within right-wing media?
Yeah, I mean, look, such an honor to be on with Julie, who without her, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, I don't think any of this would be being talked about. So in terms of the right, I mean, they really latched onto this idea, I think, particularly in the wake of Julie's reporting, because of his connections to people, Epstein's connections to people like Bill Clinton. And I think in particularly after Epstein's death in 2019, people got this sense on the right that like there was this Epstein client list that was going to reveal all of these, you know, particularly Democrats that they didn't like in Hollywood, Bill Clinton, in banking, everywhere. They really kind of ran wild with this idea that I don't really think was based on the facts for the most part. And it got mixed up with conspiracy theories like QAnon, and it became kind of like a holy grail for the right. They thought that, you know, once the client list came out, really Democrats would be defeated and they'd be revealed as pedophiles and all this stuff. As I said, I think Epstein's mysterious death in 2019 also really obviously was a very high profile event that brought a lot more attention to the case. And so as a result, I mean, look, you had people who are now in the Trump administration, like FBI Director Kash Patel or Vice President J.D. Vance, who were saying, you know, we've got to get this client list, all this stuff. And so that put even more pressure on this information to come out.
Before we get to the client list, I'm trying to understand from within the right wing sort of political sphere, and specifically the sort of right wing conspiracy sphere, why we often, it seems, hear about child molestation and predation across various different types of cases. It just seems to be such an animating issue. You mentioned QAnon, Pizzagate, for the folks who remember that. Why is it such an animating issue within that political bubble, Will?
You know, I think it's very emotionally resonant. I think it dovetails. I mean, look, we could go back centuries to the idea of like Jewish blood libel, the idea that like people are doing nefarious things to children in the night. But it is a very passionate issue for people, even often when I think the cases are really overblown. I mean, we can look at the satanic panic in the 80s. As you said, I mean, I think there's a lot of religious resonance. There's a lot of emotional resonance. Often, you know, people are legitimately sexually abused, and then when they grow up, these stories have they see themselves in these stories, or as you say, though, it is a recurring thing. And whether it's the Epstein case, which obviously has a lot of facts behind it, or these totally farcical fake cases like Pizzagate, it is something that we see over and over. And I think people, you know, I mean, frankly, they find it a lot more interesting and exciting than it's kind of a boring policy debate about taxes or tariffs. And so I think that is why I think particularly kind of the Trump era Republican Party has seen this as a really effective vehicle.
And Julie, I want to bring you back in the conversation, because what Will is talking about, I mean, there's this the conspiracy of, you know, pedophiles and, you know, trafficking and all this. But then you look at the actual facts of the Epstein case. And there are so many people who are well-connected, who are very wealthy, who have these connections to Jeffrey Epstein. Can you sort of shine the light on some of the facts that sort of fuel the conspiracies here? Because he's connected to, for example, Prince Andrew. There was even the president, Donald Trump, seen as friends with him. Can you sort of help us weave some of these connections that sort of grew into these conspiracy theories?
Well, Epstein fancied himself as this brilliant businessman, Wall Street guy, who also dabbled in things like advanced science, mathematical formulas. And some of what he did was surround himself with really intelligent, powerful people. Just to sort of, I think, confirm to himself that he was as brilliant as he sort of felt that he was. It was like a confirmation that he could surround himself with all these people. And quite frankly, some of it was, he was full of himself, and these people kind of put up with him to some degree because he was wealthy. They wanted money from him. They wanted him to invest in their projects. They wanted him to get donate money. Harvard University, he had a connection with Harvard for a very many, many years, donated a lot of money to him. So of course, he was surrounding himself with not only powerful people that other powerful people that had money, but also academics, Nobel Peace Prize winners even. This was part of his MO. He liked to surround himself with all these people. And then with some of them, especially the wealthy ones, he acted as their so-called investor or tried to persuade them to invest their money with him. And he was also astute at being able to find out their weak spot. So, for example, if there was something that they were trying to, a cause, for example, breast cancer, he would offer to make a huge donation to their foundation. So he used different ways to ingratiate himself with these people that had money in order for him to be able to make money. These were business, business transactions. And in many cases, these girls and young women were pawns in that because one of the other ways he used to ingratiate himself with powerful and wealthy people was to send young women to their hotel room or connect, link them up with girls and young women.
And of course, we haven't really gotten to the Donald Trump of this all.
Yeah.
Julie, what do we know about the relationship between Trump and Epstein? Because there's a lot of speculation that there is was a deeper conspiracy between the two men. But what do we know? And do you have any lingering questions about their relationship?
Well, there of course are lots of lingering questions and lots that we don't know. There has been no evidence to, linking him directly to Epstein's sex trafficking, none that we know of right now. However, we do know that they were friends, and it is somewhat troubling, I think, to the victims in particular, that he is now calling this a hoax, because this was a very serious crime against children in many cases, and to now dismiss it after, the Trump administration and Trump himself to some degree has promoted it as some big conspiracy that was covered up, and now calling it a hoax is unfortunate because it is a serious crime against a lot of young people, a lot of young children, women and women. So I don't think you can kind of, use it to promote your political agenda on one hand and then dismiss it when it doesn't fit your political agenda on the other hand.
Yeah, I wanted to. We're about to go to a break in about a minute and a half, Julie. But I wanted to follow up and ask you. I mean, the president has said he would like the attorney general to open up the grand jury transcript files. I want you to, since you've dealt with these types of court documents and have followed this case so extensively, your understanding of what files like that would contain.
Well, every case is different, but in this particular case, I'm sure that it contains the minimum amount of information that they wanted to present to a grand jury in order to get an indictment against Epstein and then later Maxwell. A grand jury investigation or the information presented to a grand jury is not your full case. It's only the amount that you deem necessary to get an indictment. So I think there's a lot of skepticism that there's going to be really anything of value in these grand jury files. I mean, we really don't know because grand juries are done in secret, so we don't know for sure. But my guess is that this isn't going to satisfy the public that wants a full accounting of exactly what happened with his crimes.
That's Julie K. Brown, investigative journalist for the Miami Herald. We've also been talking with Will Sommer, senior writer for The Bulwark. We'll have much more on the other side of this break. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Our question, do you think all of the Epstein files should be released? And how do you think the decision will impact President Trump's relationship with his supporters? We're going to get much more into that on the other side of this break. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking about the Jeffrey Epstein files, how this case has spun out of control for the Trump administration, and why it has recaptured public attention. Helping to wade through all the controversy with us is Julie K. Brown, investigative journalist for the Miami Herald, who helped expose Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. She is the author of Perversion of Justice, the Jeffrey Epstein story. We also have Will Sommer, a senior writer for The Bulwark, who reports on conservative media and conspiracy theories. And Cherry, let's keep this conversation going right now with our listeners.
And we invite you to join in if you're listening at home or elsewhere. Our questions of the day are this. Do you think all of the Epstein files should be released? And how do you think the decision will impact President Trump's relationship with his supporters? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, put those comments in the live chat. David from YouTube says, parts of the U.S. justice system seem very corrupt, very sad when you consider the founding fathers tried passionately to create an equal and fair system for all. We need a reset button. Ron comments, it should all be released. We need to know who the perverts are in our government and in our corporations. Republicans should stop impeding justice.
Yeah, in some ways, it's been hard to get the comments into the conversation because it's basically just political bickering back and forth. Mm-hmm. The Republicans are to blame. The Democrats are to blame, which kind of gives us a sense of where we are with this story right now. And so, Will, let me ask you, what was the moment you think that really set off some of the right-wing MAGA folks when it comes to Trump's actions regarding the Epstein case and the Epstein files? What was the pivot moment where we actually started to see some fracture?
Sure. So, I mean, we've seen for months now the administration has kind of botched the rollout here of these files. You know, famously, they gave these kind of right-wing influencers some binders that had all this public information, but was sort of billed as like a big secret. Pam Bondi was making these various claims that don't seem to have been backed up about the kinds of evidence they had. But the real issue came maybe about 3 weeks ago now, when late on a Sunday night, they released via Axios this DOJ memo that said, essentially, you know, Epstein killed himself. The case is over. We are not going to charge anyone else, and we won't be releasing any more files. And there was really no sense of why this happened like that. Like there was no like deadline or anything that they had to hit to decide on what would happen. And so that really set off the right, that memo, and then Trump doubled down on it and really sort of escalated in the coming days, where he went from saying, you know, anyone who believed there was more to the Epstein story was stupid. Then he started insulting his followers and calling them weaklings, and he didn't want their support. And it's really kind of spun out from there. So I would say that real pivot moment was that DOJ memo. Famously, that caused a lot of trouble within the administration. Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino supposedly wanted to resign because he was so upset about how the rollout had gone. And that is really what set it off. And so now I think the administration is trying to go back to this period before the memo, where it wasn't clear what files would be coming out. Maybe some files would be coming out at an indeterminate date. And it was all very hazy. And so no one could really be that mad at them. But I don't think they're succeeding in getting back to that status quo.
Yeah, hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Amy from Barnegat Light on the line. Amy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious where the law falls with the concept of FOIA and the issue of redacted information. As I'm hearing it, what they're talking about is that once they do release the files, which it looks like something's going to be forced eventually, there's going to be all these redactions in them. This is not somebody who was in the military. It's not classified information for any reason. So I'm kind of wondering why. Here's a chance of any one of our representatives or senators to make the point that they owe us all of the information.
Yeah. Thank you. That's Amy from Barnegat Light. And that sort of piggybacks on my question. And I'm not sure whether Julie or Will is the right person to ask this. I just wonder what is still out there. Like, what exactly exists that people feel like they need to see? And we've heard this client list that people have been referring to, and what is already out there? So just sort of like what, you know, what is sort of floating out there in this atmosphere that's hidden from the public? And maybe, Julie, you can help us.
Well, there's an awful lot out there.
Yeah.
You know, when Pam Bondi announced that, you know, the list where the files were on her desk, I sort of laughed because I know there's so much material. It probably couldn't even fit in her office. I mean, this is years and years and years, two decades of investigative work. And so it's hard to know exactly what is in there. But there's most of it we really don't know. And as for the caller's questions about redactions, mm-hmm. remember, these were underage, you know, sexual assault victims. So we don't want to reveal their names. So, of course, they should be redacted in any other identifying material. In some cases, if you have witnesses that perhaps agree to talk to authorities but don't want their identities known, and they're witnesses that are helping the investigations, I could see how some of those names would be redacted. But there's so much material that still can be redacted. I mean, they are either redacted or they should be just released because they, for example, they haven't released his plane records. I don't see any reason why we can't see where his plane was flying. I don't see any reason why we can't understand why authorities didn't, for example, go and search his island properties right before, if not right after he was arrested. They waited a couple weeks before they went to the island and executed that search warrant there. I think that there were a lot of mistakes on the part of the Justice Department, and that is another reason why they would prefer to redact things, because they don't want the public to know that they didn't do some of the things that they perhaps should have done.
I can already see, however, mm-hmm. in our comments, some folks who I would assume are on the right end of the spectrum, spinning this back on Biden, saying, look, if there's anything in there about Trump, this is something Michael yeah. and Harry are saying, in Walter, you know, if there was something in there about Trump, why wouldn't have Biden and Merrick Garland already released that? They would be very well incentivized to do so. So first of all, I guess I could ask you that question, Will, straight up, but also it feels like very fluidly we're moving back into a situation where this, at least some of Trump supporters, are creating these deflection shields on this issue and bouncing it back into some sort of left-wing conspiracy. Your thoughts on that, Will?
Yeah, I mean, that has been sort of the main rhetorical gambit here as this has spun out of the administration's control. They've said, well, if there was anything bad about Trump, it would have been released already, which I think is in a way sort of telling on themselves that they would see what is a very serious investigation about sex trafficking as they would say, well, you know, if we had an opportunity right. to use this as a political football, we certainly would. And as we know, they did. So I think, first of all, you know, the Wall Street Journal article about the letter that Trump supposedly wrote to Epstein, you know, that obviously had not come out in the past. I mean, it's kind of sort of an airtight logic to it, in that you can say, well, if there's anything bad about Trump, it would have come out already. So now anything bad that does come out about Trump is clearly fake. And I mean, they're really leaning on that heavily. I don't know that that's going to convince a lot of people. We have to keep in mind, it's not just Trump supporters who are interested in this case, or Democrats. I mean, I think a lot of independents who maybe aren't that politically active, I mean, this is such an evocative case, they've become interested in it. And we're seeing these kind of like bro podcasters who were very successful, Trump was very successful appealing to, start to say, like, do they think we're stupid? You know, what is really going on here?
The Andrew Schultzes of the world. But I do want to narrow in a little bit, Will, on whether there is something specific about this case, not just Trump's actions or maybe his seeming hypocrisy here, because he's waffled on things before. He's not always consistent. Is there something, though, about his actions on this particular issue that can kind of pierce the veil? Maybe it pierces the veil of him as the enemy of the elites or something else that I'm not thinking of. Like, there's something about this that presents a unique challenge for him politically, whether with his base or just with the American public in general.
I think it is a uniquely kind of sticky and resonant issue. I mean, we've seen already in the past few weeks how difficult it is for the administration to move past this. And I think it's also not just about Jeffrey Epstein or sex trafficking. I think particularly for the right, they have made Epstein broadly, sort of a symbol of the idea that elites are getting away with things,
right,
that they are screwing around with the common man, that they are acting with impunity. And we know that's the kind of populism Trump has really leaned into. Mm-hmm. And so I think the danger of the Epstein case for the president is that it suggests the opposite. It suggests that he's protecting something unpopular, even if he's not implicated in them, which you know, remains to be seen, that he is defending the establishment broadly.
And, well, I know we're going to let you go momentarily, but I just want to ask you, I mean, House Speaker Mike Johnson originally had come out and said that he was pushing for transparency and then sort of backpedaled a bit, you know, sent Congress in recess to recess, giving the Trump administration this space. Do you think the president, I mean, how long do you think this leeway will last before, you know, even folks who support the president sort of step back in and say, we need transparency now?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're already starting to see some Republican lawmakers break with the administration on this. That's why they've had to close the House early this week in order to avoid a vote on the Epstein files. So we don't know how many Republicans would break, but clearly it's enough, they think, to pass the resolution to open up the Epstein files. And so that's the, I mean, you know, now they're headed into the August recess, and I don't think this issue is really going away. I think barring some truly enormous new news event, I think this is something the administration is going to continue to deal with in the fall. I mean, it's stuck around for at least 6 years now since Epstein's death, and I think it has more staying power still.
We do have to say bye to Will Sommer, senior writer for The Bulwark. Thanks so much for your time this hour, Will. We really do appreciate it, and hopefully we'll have you back on the program another day.
Thank you.
We still got Julie K. Brown with us as we wrap up the hour. And so, Julie.
Can I go back to the caller's questions about
absolutely.
Why didn't the Biden? There's a couple things to remember here. Under the Biden administration, they convicted Ghislaine Maxwell. They had an open criminal investigation. And whenever you have it, it doesn't matter whether you're Republican person, a Democrat person, an independent person, when you have an open criminal investigation, you don't open your files. You're trying to get a conviction. You don't want everyone to know what evidence you have because you're trying to get a conviction. After Maxwell's conviction, and even to this day, she's appealing that criminal conviction. So there's at least some or a good deal of records that they don't want to release because they still technically have an open criminal case. That's number one. And number two, there is bad people in this story on both sides of the political aisle. This is not a Republican-Democrat issue. This is a sexual assault case. And there were bad people on both sides. There is very likely people who are named in those files who have a lot of money and have donated a lot of that money to both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We know that Epstein, for example, donated lots of money to Democrats and to Republicans. So, you know, and that's the way these billionaires often operate. They donate money to both sides. So it could very well be that, you know, in between the criminal case still being open and the fact that maybe the names in there are Democratic donors, that there are two issues that maybe are reasons why the Biden administration didn't decide on its own to release some of those files.
I think about Ghislaine Maxwell that you just mentioned. We now hear that you know, Attorney General is very likely to interview her. And I there are thoughts that sort of spring up given the lack of independence between the Attorney General and the president. And just your thoughts on bringing her into this case while there's open calls for transparency and just the conflict of interest that could possibly arise.
Well, let me tell you one thing. There is no way that the victims want her to get any kind of we don't need another sweetheart deal in this case. We already had one, and this is where we are today as a result of that. The reason she is in prison is because she was, to some degree, the mastermind of Epstein's operation. She was the one that came up with the idea of recruiting all these young girls from in and around Palm Beach, from spas and gyms and anywhere she saw young girls. So she was the mastermind, and the victims believe in some ways she was worse than Epstein because she manipulated them. She used them. She made them feel like they were safe. They were willing to go with her. And she told them, you know, the story that she could find a wealthy man who would help them with their careers or with their college. So she was the one that they look upon as the mastermind in some respects of this. And they would not want to see her get any kind of a deal.
Real quick, Julie, before we go, in light of Trump's latest statements on this case, do you start to wonder if he is more involved than what the actual factual record shows to this point? Because I get the sense that historically, that's not really where you were shining your light brightest. But do you wonder now, just with what's happened the last couple of weeks, whether there is something more there?
I mean, just as a journalist, you would be curious about that. But I don't think there's any indicator of that, to be honest with you. Even this latest letter that he wrote to Epstein on his 50th birthday. I don't know. I just think if they were friends, that doesn't mean he committed any crimes. You know, so I'm skeptical about how involved he is. But I do think that there's other people in those files that he may be trying to protect.
We will have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Julie K. Brown, Philly's Julie K. Brown, investigative journalist for the Miami Herald, who helped expose Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. She's the author of Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story. Julie, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Yes, appreciate your perspective. And of course, thank you to everybody who wrote and called in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Diana Martinez and Tina Calliquet, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you again tomorrow.